Because we cannot know what God is, but only what he is not. We cannot consider how he is, but only how he is not. Today we're starting our series on Thomas Aquinas' five proofs for the existence of God, the five ways that the existence of God can be proven. And like usual, I'm going to give my conclusion at the beginning of the series and tell you that Aquinas' five proofs don't necessarily prove the existence of God. But I wanted to spend a bit of time talking about it because we're about to dive into Christian mysticism. And this is a kind of a nice segue into Christian theology, because Aquinas was, of course, a Dominican friar from the 13th century. And Dominicans are known to be an order of Catholic priests, which very much dive into the idea of theology, of epistemology, knowing what's true and what's not, what the existence of things is. They were very much involved in science and, of course, alchemy. There's some really interesting stories about Aquinas and in alchemy, which I won't get to in this episode, but maybe somebody else has done an episode on Aquinas that you might want to check out. Really fascinating guy. But, you know, this podcast is not about people. It's about ideas. So I want to talk about Aquinas' ideas for the existence of God. Because really, the five proofs are a fantastic introduction for anybody into how to logically think about philosophy and, by extension, into spirituality. Because one of the things that I always focus on the show is finding some scientific method that can be put to use in our attainment of gnosis, of knowledge, of deep, spiritual, important knowledge. And while nowadays science and spirituality may have become disparate from each other, this wasn't always the case. In fact, throughout much of the history of science, science and spirituality were very much intertwined, and we can see this in the spirit of the Dominican friars, for example. So this will be a multi-part series because I want to keep each episode a little bit shorter because I think there's a lot to go through in how Aquinas derives at his conclusions. And again, it's a great exercise in determining how you know something to be true while beginning from a point of view, a vantage point of belief. You know, Aquinas is another really great quote: "To one who has faith, no explanation is necessary. To one without faith, no explanation is possible." And this lies at the core of finding answers to the really hard questions in life. How it is that we came to be, but more importantly, why does anything have to be? And that's something that we're going to be diving into in this series of episodes, in particular once we get to the third way in which Aquinas tries to prove the existence of God. Now, I do want to talk about the first way. It's generally called the argument from motion, because this is kind of one of the building steps into getting to the meat of Aquinas' proof of the existence of God. And it's an argument that we've discussed in some ways many times. And the logic that Aquinas uses may be very familiar to regular listeners of the podcast, because generally I call it the turtles all the way down theory, in which one thing needs another to cause it, to another to cause it, and another to cause it, etc. But the first argument, this argument for motion, is rather simple. Because at a core, science and philosophy and spirituality are about observing how the world works around you and trying to deduce the best possible explanation for why that thing is true. And so, of course, Aquinas begins this first proof by using the senses, because this is all we have in order to be able to acquire knowledge and understand the world. And of course, traditionally, there are five senses, right? You have your sense of touch, you have your sense of taste, of smell, of sight, and of hearing. If you go into some other circles, you might hear more senses. And if you dive into maybe some more science, evolutionary science, into other species, you might learn about even more senses, right? Like sharks, for example, have this magnetic sense where they can sense the magnetic energy emitting from another life form, and they use that as a way to find their prey. But for us humans, at least, we have these five typical senses, and this is what Aquinas wants to use. in order to determine whether God exists or not. This is a great starting point, because this is how we should begin all of our observations in trying to determine some kind of truth. And what I find more interesting than the fact that Aquinas goes to this proofs is the fact that Aquinas never actually sets out to prove the existence of the biblical God, of the Catholic God. He just proves the existence of a divine being that created all things. Because regardless of what you might think or hear from others, even within the Catholic segment of Christianity that, you know, generally we consider as maybe a little more Baroque, a little more hard-headed even, in trying to understand the world and its place, and the place of Christians and non-Christians in it, Aquinas was a very studious person, and he derived a lot of these observations by reading not just Catholic scripture and not just thinking about the world solely based on a skewed perspective of being a Catholic. And so he studied all aspects of many different religions, both major religions like Hinduism, for example, but also minor belief systems from smaller groups around the world, at least groups that he would be in contact with, particularly in Asia. So how does Aquinas go about doing this? And it's a very simple, logical way that he goes about setting for proving the existence of God. Again, he begins with the senses. And he notices that through his senses, he sees that things are in motion. And by seeing that things are in motion, he notices very cleverly that things move from a potential state of motion to an actual state of motion, something that I discussed a lot in the previous episode, and that the only time that actual motion begins, it's when there is something that's already actively in motion forcing an object that is not moving to go into motion. Now, this is very astute. It's very simple, because you can see this all around you. You know, back in the day, I used to be a pool player, billiards player. And back then, it was just kind of a fun thing for me to do on, you know, my lunch break or whatever, maybe after school sometimes. But while the game may seem simple and rather fun if you follow the rules, it's an extremely complex game, because you have to understand how the laws of physics works. And the thing is, you don't need to be a physicist to do it, you just need to understand how objects affect each other's movement. And so when you get good at that, when you get to determine the amount of force to apply to a cue stick to hit a ball in order to make it move at a certain angle, travel at a certain speed in order to enact its will upon another ball so that that secondary ball may hit a hole, things get very intricate. It's a very complicated game, very fascinating game. But if you just treat it as a game, then that's all it simply is. But once you begin understanding how these things work, things become much more complicated. You can become a much better player because you understand the rules that the game abides by. You understand the rules that cause things in motion to enact their own energy, their own will, their own agency upon something which is not. And so, of course, Aquinas very astutely decides and observes that no object can be both in actual motion and in potential motion at the same time. One precedes the other. He also very astutely observes that nothing can move itself. Now, this is when you can begin to see how logic works. Because you can easily say, well, that's not true at all, right? If I'm sitting down and I decide to get up, there's nothing forcing me to get up, right? Maybe if I was a child and I'm sitting in bed watching YouTube, which my kids love to do, of course, and I go into the room and say, hey, get off of YouTube, you need to go and do the dishes, then, you know, very obviously, the observation is, I'm the one causing my kid to get out of bed and go into motion to perform another task. But you say, I'm an adult. Nobody's forcing me to do anything. I do whatever I want, whenever I want, hopefully, maybe. Or so you think. And if I want to sit and watch TV and do nothing else, And all of a sudden, I decide to get up. Nobody's making me get up. There's no actor enacting on me their will forcing me to get up. I just decided to get up. But of course, if you have an understanding of how these things work, you know that's not the case at all. Because there has to be something enacting for you to turn potential into motion. And so it could be that maybe you need to go to the bathroom, so you get up to go to the bathroom. Or maybe you feel like you decided that you wanted to get up to prove to me that there was no actor to do it. But see, then on itself, my actions are acting on you to go from potential motion into actual motion. And if we look at this even physiologically, there's something going on. Because you just don't get up and all of a sudden you're standing. There's things going into motion that cause another thing to go into motion for you to get up. So first you have to have this thought, we'll say, this reflex coming from your brain, sending electrical energy down into your legs. That energy sends a signal. The signal tells the muscle fibers in your legs to get up. You get up and you move around. So you see, there was something actually causing you to go from potential to actual. There's always something that is moving the next thing. Now, if you take this in a very small system of things, you can easily come to a primal cause that caused something to happen, right? Maybe you were meditating out in the woods and you heard a sound through the trees, and that sound was the mover that caused you to move. It's very simple. But what if you begin to take this idea into a much larger system? What if you take this idea into an infinite system? Then you begin to realize that the secret of motion can't just be turtles all the way down. There has to be something at the bottom holding all these turtles in place. We're going to dive much deeper into this as we go into each of the other proofs. But for Aquinas, this very first thing, this first mover, has to be God. Now, of course, don't get bogged down by the terminology. Remember that the word God is simply a symbol standing in the place of some actual thing. This is why I began this episode with the Aquinas quote that I did. Because we cannot know what God is, but only what he is not. We cannot consider how he is, but only how he is not. Because if you begin with this argument for motion, to talk about this first mover, you can very easily come to the conclusion that there must be a first mover. When you stood up, there was a series of events that unfolded that caused you to get up. And what caused those events to occur? What set those events into motion? There was an originating event. And what caused that event? It was something else, and something else, and something else. And ultimately, there has to be something that causes something else to move. And that is God. Now, if you want to look at it from a purely scientific way, you can go all the way back to the Big Bang and say, well, the Big Bang is your idea of God. Or maybe an actual turtle is your idea of God. It could be a bearded man. It could be a lady in a white robe. It could be an elephant. It could be a rock. Or it could be nothingness. But the idea remains the same. Now the question, of course, becomes, well, in that case, what was there at the beginning that caused God to move? And this is one of the typical arguments that I hear about why this proof is kind of nonsensical. Well, you're just kind of taking an easy way out, because you have to have some kind of foundation that doesn't allow you to go back any further. So your belief in God is flawed in that sense, because there had to be something before it. I've heard this from people that espouse, for example, the Big Bang. And the thing is, a lot of the terminology becomes the same, because even if the universe began as this minute point in space and time, you still want to perform experiments to figure out how it is that this thing came to be. And you want to perform experiments to figure out what came before this event that began all of existence. And then you run into other problems, because at that point in time, there would be no time to consider. So maybe you can go and recreate the conditions that resulted in the Big Bang to a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a nanosecond. But you can never go back to point zero, because there would be no point zero. If you think about this mathematically, you see this very easily, very simply. Because see, the answer to some of the hardest questions that we ask often has a very simple solution. You look at the world and you can analyze it mathematically. Let's say you were taking inventory of your possessions and you begin counting them. Maybe you have one house and the house has three bedrooms, and in each bedroom there's a bed, so there's three beds. And maybe that means that there's three people, maybe four people, five people, I don't know. Maybe there's 10 people in the house. You count those people, and each of those people has five pairs of pants, so now you have 50 pairs of pants. And that seems like a very simple and easy way to look at the world. But when you go down deep into, say, the mathematics of the situation, it becomes a little more complicated than that. Because maybe your cat or your dog ate your pants, and now you have half a pair of pants. And so you see, if you start going back in time, you run into this problem as well. Because there's an infinite number of points in between each moment in time. And so I've heard the argument from some. This is a thing called the Kalam argument for creation, for existence. In which you can't have infinite things. Things can't go back infinitely in time. The reasons for why I'm not going to go into now, because that'd be a series of episodes unto itself. But it somehow relates to this idea of a first mover, because in this Kalam argument, you have the idea that basically the world is kind of like a set of dominoes. And there has to be something pushing the first domino in order to cause this chain reaction, moving down the line, hitting the next domino, until you get to the end. But see, there is no end, because your perception of time continues moving forward, continues causing another domino to fall. And so this chain is infinite. It goes on forever. The thing is, you might not see it. You can't see it, because your perception, your awareness, isn't infinite. If it was infinite, you'd be actual God. But you're not. Now, yes, you are it. You are all of it. You are God. But you are not all of God. You're a tiny perspective, a tiny point of view that God is using to look out to affect other things in this infinitely intertwined chain of events, of motions. Now, if you had the perspective to see all these things, of figuring out, for example, exactly every shot that you'd have to make in this billiards game that you're playing, then you would begin to approximate what it would be like to be God. You know, the Sufi mystics took this really at heart. In particular, people like Ibn Arabi, whom I wanted to do an episode last year, and I started diving into it, and decided I couldn't. Because the way that Ibn Arabi describes the fullness of God is in some ways reminiscent of the thought experiment that I've used many times in this podcast of having you picture this infinite circle. And the thing is that there's nothing wrong with not being able to picture this infinite circle. Just like there's nothing wrong with you never being to achieve this ultimate God state that everyone seems to want to do. There's nothing wrong with that, because you're a finite piece of an infinite puzzle. And so if you're a finite piece, how could you ever approach this? And so ultimately, to me, what these five proofs show is maybe not a proof for the existence of God in a logical, philosophical sense, but a proof that an ultimate divine creator has no choice but to exist. And these two are very different ideas. You know, Aquinas once said, if the highest aim of a captain were to preserve his ship, he would keep it in port forever. And isn't that true? When we try to look at matters of spirituality. Because if the point of all this was for us to attain some kind of eternal life, then there would be no point at all. Because if we wanted to achieve eternal life, we wouldn't do anything. We'd probably sit at home all day and simply meditate and have someone come and feed us, maybe, and bathe us as we meditate. So we conserve all our energy, never put it into motion, be still as rocks. And then what would be the point of it? There would be no point at all. All right, that's going to be it for this first part in the series. So if you're a member of the Patreon, you will get part two of the series tomorrow. If you are not, then you'll get it in 2 or 3 days. And I'm going to be releasing the episodes this way from now on, because I'm gonna put a little bit of a window in between when patrons get the episodes and when everybody else does. So, you know, for a little while, it's been a day or two. But I want to have about a week or 10-day or 2-week window in between. So on this series, patrons will get it every single day. So one a day for the next 6 days. I'm actually going to be tying some of the stuff from these five proofs into a truly incredible piece of Gnostic literature that I've mentioned before, but haven't really dove into on the podcast, the Tripartite Tractate. So I recommend you give that a read through if you can. You can go to gnosis.org and read it for free. You don't need to buy any books or anything. But that'll be the conclusion of all this. And for everybody else, you know, it'll take a couple of weeks before we get through this series. But it's going to be really interesting, so I hope you enjoy that. It's only the beginning, so if you felt like that was kind of a primer, kind of an introduction, it was meant to be that way. Because like any good argument, any good piece of logic, any good piece of philosophy, you can't just go in full force and try to explain your theory in full, because then you lose everybody, because you might have found something that somebody else hasn't. And if you don't lay the groundwork for what that idea is, you just won't get it. So we start simple. We start with motion. For the next episode, we're going to talk about causes, the argument from efficient causes. And that'll set up us pretty nicely to talk about possibility and necessity, which I find a third way really interesting. And of course, none of these ideas, oddly enough, or maybe not, are new or original to Aquinas. He was just a very astute guy that was able to deduce further ideas from Aristotle. Because, of course, we know that a lot of Christianity is based on Greek ideas. Something we talk about during the Gnosticism series, and something we'll get into a lot more as we go deeper and deeper into this Christian mysticism series, which will probably last us a couple of months. And I want to make it clear that in no way am I trying to demean any Christian sect in this series. All I want to do is start from the beginning and try to build a base and try to understand the things that are written and the things that are said and see if those things actually align with what we find in Scripture. So Aquinas is a great place to begin from because, again, he was a Catholic priest. And so if it made sense to him as a Catholic priest and he was able to arrive at these ideas from a Christian perspective, that he was able to use the ideas of others outside of his own culture, outside of his own belief system, then maybe we can do the same now, looking back, and try to derive some fresh knowledge, or maybe find some knowledge that's always existed. Anyways, that's going to wrap up this episode. Thank you for listening. Of course, check out the Patreon, patreon.com/thealchemicalmind. Check out the website for all the links, thealchemicalmind.com. And if you want to email Martin at the Alchemical Mind is the place to do so. I'm more than happy to reply, and I do check those very regularly. And of course, Twitter at MindAlchemical. But that's it for this episode. Thank you for listening, and as always, remember that you are it. All of it.